The Story of the Waffen SS by Leon de Grel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm asked to talk to you about the great unknown of World War II, the Waffen SS. It is somewhat amazing that the organisation, which was both political and military, and which during World War II united more than 1 million fighting volunteers, should still be officially ignored. Why? Why is it that the official record still virtually ignores this extraordinary army of volunteers, an army which was at the vortex of the most gigantic struggle affecting the entire world? The answer may well be found in the fact that the most striking feature of the Waffen-SS was that it was composed of volunteers from some 30 different countries. What cause gathered them, and why did they volunteer their lives? Was it a German phenomenon? At the beginning, yes. Initially, the Waffen-SS amounted to less than 200 members. It grew consistently until 1940, when it evolved into a second phase, the Germanic Waffen-SS. In addition to Germans from Germany, northwestern Europeans and descendants of Germans from all across Europe enlisted. Then, in 1941, during the great clash with the Soviet Union, rose the European Waffen-SS. Young men from the most distant countries fought together on the Russian front. No one knew anything about the Waffen-SS for most of the years preceding the war. The Germans themselves took some time to recognise the distinctiveness of the Waffen-SS. Hitler rose to the chancellorship, democratically, winning at the ballot box. He ran electoral campaigns like any other politician. He addressed meetings, advertised on billboards. His message attracted capacity audiences. More and more people liked what he had to say, and more people voted members of his party into Congress. Hitler did not come to power by force, but was duly elected by the people and duly installed as Chancellor by the President of Germany, General von Hindenburg. His government was legitimate and democratic. In fact, only two of his followers were included in the cabinet. Later, he succeeded always through the electoral process in increasing his majority. When some elections gave him up to 90% of the vote, Hitler earned every vote on his own merit. During his campaigns, Hitler faced formidable enemies, the power establishment, who had no qualms whatsoever in tampering with the electoral process. He had to face the Weimar establishment and its well-financed left-wing and liberal parties and highly organised bloc of 6 million Communist Party members. Only the most fearless and relentless struggle to convince people to vote for him enabled Hitler to obtain a democratic majority. In those days, the Waffen-SS was not even a factor. There was, of course, the SA with some 3 million men. They were rank-and-file members of the National Socialist Workers' Party, but certainly not an army. Their main function was to protect party candidates from communist violence, and the violence was murderous indeed. More than 500 National Socialists were murdered by the communists, and thousands were grievously injured. The SA was a volunteer, non-government organisation, and as soon as Hitler rose to power, he could no longer avail himself of its help. He had to work within the system that he had been elected to serve. He came in at a state of disadvantage. He had to contend with an entrenched bureaucracy appointed by the old regime. In fact, when the war started in 1939, 70% of German bureaucrats had been appointed by the old regime and did not belong to Hitler's party. Hitler could not count on the support of the church hierarchy either. Both big business and the Communist Party were totally hostile to his programs. On top of all this, extreme poverty existed and 6 million workers were unemployed. No country in Europe had ever known so many people to be out of work. So here is a man, quite isolated. The 3 million SA party members are not in the government. They vote and help win the elections, but they cannot supplant the entrenched bureaucracy in the government posts. The SA also was unable to exert influence on the army because the top brass, fearful of competition, was hostile to them. This hostility reached such a point that Hitler was faced with a wrenching dilemma. What to do with the millions of followers who had helped him to power? He could not abandon them. The army was a highly organized power structure, although only numbering 100,000, as dictated by the Treaty of Versailles. It exerted great influence in the affairs of state. The president of Germany was Field Marshal von Hindenburg, and the army was a privileged caste. Almost all the officers belonged to the upper classes of society. It was impossible for Hitler to take on the powerful army frontally. Hitler was elected democratically, and he could not do what Stalin did, to have firing squads execute the entire military establishment. Stalin killed 30,000 high-ranking officers. That was Stalin's way to make room for his own trusted commissars. Such drastic methods could not occur in Germany, and unlike Stalin, Hitler was surrounded by international enemies. His election had provoked their rage. He had gone to the voters directly, without the intermediary of the establishment parties. His party platform included an appeal for racial purity in Germany, as well as a return of power to the people. Such tenets so infuriated world Jewry that in 1933 it officially declared war on Germany. Contrary to what one is told, Hitler had limited power and was quite alone. How this man ever survived those early years defies comprehension. Only the fact that Hitler was an exceptional genius explains his survival against all odds. Abroad and at home, Hitler had to bend over backwards just to demonstrate his goodwill. But despite all his efforts, Hitler was gradually being driven into a corner. The feud between the SA and the army was coming to a head. His old comrade, Ernst Röhm, chief of the SA, wanted to follow Stalin's example and physically eliminate the army brass. The showdown resulted in the death of Röhm, either by suicide or murder, and many of his assistants, with the army picking up the pieces and putting the SA back in its place. At this time, the only SS to be found in Germany were in Chancellor Hitler's personal guard, 180 men in all. They were young men of exceptional qualities, but without any political role. Their duties consisted of guarding the chancellery and presenting arms to visiting dignitaries. It was from this minuscule group of 180 men that a few years later would spring an army of 1 million soldiers, an army of unprecedented valour extending its call throughout Europe. After Hitler was compelled to acknowledge the superiority of the army, he realized that the brass would never support his revolutionary social programs. It was an army of aristocrats. Hitler was a man of the people, a man who succeeded in wiping out unemployment, a feat unsurpassed to this day. Within 2 years, he gave work to 6 million Germans and got rid of rampant poverty. In 5 years, the German worker doubled his income without inflation. Hundreds of thousands of beautiful homes were built for the workers at a minimal cost. Each home had a garden to grow flowers and vegetables. All the factories were provided with sports fields, swimming pools, and attractive and decent workshops. For the first time, paid vacations were created. The communists and the capitalists had never offered paid vacations. This was Hitler's creation. He organized the famous Strength Through Joy programs, which meant that workers could, at affordable prices, board passenger ships and visit any part of the world. All these social improvements did not please the establishment. Big business tycoons and international bankers were worried, but Hitler stood up to them. A business can make profits, but only if people are paid decently and are allowed to live and work in dignity. People, not profits, come first. This was only one of Hitler's reforms. He initiated hundreds of others. He literally rebuilt Germany. In a few years, more than 5,000 miles of freeways were built. For the worker, the affordable Volkswagen was created. Any worker could get this car on a payment of 5 marks a week. It was unprecedented in Europe. Thanks to the freeways, the worker, for the first time, could visit any part of Germany wherever they liked. The same programs applied to the farmers and the middle class. Hitler realized that if his social reforms were to proceed free of sabotage, he needed a powerful lever, a lever that commanded respect. Hitler still did not confront the army, but skillfully started to build up the SS. He desperately needed the SS because, above all, Hitler was a political man. To him, war was the last resort. His aim was to convince people, to obtain their loyalty, particularly the younger generation. He knew that the establishment-minded top brass would oppose him at every turn, and he was right. Through the high-ranking officers, the establishment plotted the overthrow of the democratically elected Hitler government. Known as the Munich Plot, the conspirators were detected in time. That was in 1938. On the 20th of July, 1944, Hitler almost lost his life when aristocratic officers planted a time bomb underneath his desk. In order not to alert the army, Hitler enlarged the SS into a force responsible for law and order. There was, of course, a German police force, but there again Hitler was unsure of their loyalty. The 150,000 police had been appointed by the Weimar regime. Hitler needed the SS not only to detect plots, but mostly to protect his reforms. As his initial Leibstandarte unit of 180 grew, other regiments were found, such as the Deutschland and the Germania. The army brass did everything to prevent SS recruitment. Hitler bypassed the obstacles by having the interior minister and not the war ministry do the recruiting. The army countered this by discouraging the recruitment of men between the ages of 18 and 45. On the grounds of national defence, privates were ordered to serve 4 years, non-commissioned officers 12, and officers 25 years. Such orders, it was thought, would stop SS recruitment dead in its tracks. But the reverse happened. Thousands of young men rushed to apply, despite the lengthy service, far more than could be accepted. The young felt the SS was the only armed force which represented their own ideas. The new formations of young SS captivated public imagination. Clad in smart black uniforms, the SS attracted more and more young men. It took 2 years from 1933 to 1935 and a constant battle of wits with the army to raise a force of 8,000 SS. At the time, the name Waffen-SS did not even exist. It was not until 1940, after the French campaign, that the SS was officially named the Waffen-SS. In 1935, they were just called the SS. However, 8,000 SS did not go far in a country of 80 million people. And Hitler had yet to devise another way to get around the army. He created the Totenkopf Guard Corps. They were really SS in disguise, but their official function was to guard the concentration camps. What were these concentration camps, I hear you ask? They were just work camps, where intractable communists were put to work. They were well treated because it was thought that they would soon be converted to patriotism. There were 2 concentration camps with a total of 3,000 men. 3,000 out of a total of 6 million card-carrying members of the Communist Party. That represents one per 2,000. Right until the war started, there were fewer than 10,000 inmates.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
The Totenkopf ploy produced four regiments. At the right moment, they would join the SS. The Totenkopf kept a low profile through an elaborate system of recruiting reserves in order to keep its strength inconspicuous. At the beginning of the war, they numbered 40,000 men. They were to be sent to 163 separate units. Meanwhile, the initial Liebstandarte regiment reached 2,800, and a fourth regiment was formed in Vienna at the time of the Anschluss. The young men who joined the SS were trained like no other army in the world. Military and academic instruction were intensive, but it was the physical training that was the most rigorous. They practiced sports with excellence. Each of them would have performed with distinction at the Olympic Games. The extraordinary physical endurance of the SS on the Russian front, which so amazed the world, was down to this intensive training. There was also ideological training. They were taught why they were fighting, what kind of Germany was being resurrected before their very eyes. They were shown how Germany was being morally united through class reconciliation and physically united through the return of the lost German homelands. They were made aware of their kinship with all the other Germans living in foreign lands, in Poland, Russia, the Sudetenland, and other parts of Europe. They were taught that all Germans represented an ethnic unity. Young SS were educated in two military academies, one in Bad Tulz, the other in Braunschweig. These academies were totally different from the grim barracks of the past. Combining aesthetics with the latest technology, they were located in the middle of hundreds of acres of beautiful countryside. Hitler was opposed to any war, particularly in Western Europe. He did not even conceive that the SS could participate in such a war. Above all, the SS was a political force. Hitler regarded Western countries as individual cultures which could be federated, but certainly not conquered. He felt that a conflict within the West would be a no-win civil war. Hitler's conception of Europe back then was far ahead of his neighbours. The mentality of 1914 to 1918, when small countries fought other small countries over bits of real estate, still prevailed in the Europe of 1939. Not so in the case of the Soviet Union, though, where internationalism had replaced nationalism. The communists never aimed at serving the interests of Russia. Communism does not limit itself to acquiring chunks of territories, but aims at total world domination. This is a dramatically new factor. This policy of world conquest is still being carried out today, whether it is in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Africa, or Poland. At the time, it was an entirely new concept. Alone, among all the leaders of the world, Hitler saw this concept as an equal threat to all nations. Hitler recalled vividly the havoc the communists unleashed in Germany at the end of World War I. Particularly in Berlin and Bavaria, the communists, under foreign orders, organized a state within a state and almost took over. For Hitler, everything pointed east. The threat was communism. Apart from his lack of interest in subjugating Western Europe, Hitler was well aware that he could not wage war on two fronts. At this point, instead of letting Hitler fight communism, the Allies made the fateful decision to attack Hitler. The so-called Western democracies allied themselves with the Soviet Union for the purpose of encircling and destroying the democratic government of Germany. The Treaty of Versailles had already amputated Germany from all sides. It was designed to keep Germany in a state of permanent economic collapse and military impotence. The Allies had ratified a string of treaties with Belgium, the newly created Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, and Romania to pressure Germany from all sides. Now, in the summer of 1939, the governments of Britain and France were secretly negotiating a full military alliance with the Soviet Union. The talks were held in Moscow, and the minutes were signed by Marshal Zhukov. I have these minutes in my possession. They are stupefying. One can read a report guaranteeing Britain and France of Soviet participation against Germany. Upon ratification, the Soviet Union was to provide the Anglo-French forces with the Soviet support of 5,500 combat planes immediately, plus the backup of the entire Soviet Air Force. Between 9,000 to 10,000 tanks would also be made available. In return, the Soviet Union demanded the Baltic states and free access to Poland. This plan called for an early joint attack. Germany was still minimally armed at that stage. The French negotiators realised that the 10,000 Soviet tanks would soon destroy the 2,000 German tanks, but did not see that they would be unlikely to stop at the French border. Likewise, the British government was quite prepared to let the Soviets take over Europe. Facing total encirclement, Hitler decided once more to make his own peace with one side or the other of the Soviet-British partnership. He turned to the British and French governments and requested formal peace talks. His quest for peace was answered by an outpouring of insults and denunciations. The international press went on an orgy of hate against Hitler, unprecedented in history. It is mind-boggling to reread those newspapers today. When Hitler made similar peace overtures to Moscow, he was surprised to find the Soviets eager to sign a peace treaty with Germany. In fact, Stalin did not sign a peace treaty for the purpose of peace. He signed to let Europe destroy itself in a war of attrition while giving him the time he needed to build up his military strength. Stalin's real intent is revealed in the minutes of the Soviet High Command, which are also in my possession. Stalin states his intent to come into the war the moment Hitler and the Western powers have annihilated each other. Stalin had great interest in making time and letting others fight first. I have read his military plans and I've seen how they were achieved. By 1941, Stalin's 10,000 tanks had increased to 17,999, and the next year it would have been 32,000, 10 times more than Germany's, and the Air Force would also have been 10 to 1 in Stalin's favour. The very week Stalin signed the peace treaty with Hitler, he gave orders to build 96 airfields on the western Soviet border. 180 of these were planned for the following year. His strategy was constant. The more the Western powers fight it out, the weaker they will be. The longer I wait, the stronger I get.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
It was under these appalling circumstances that World War II started, a war which was offered to the Soviets on a silver platter. Aware of Stalin's preparations, Hitler knew that he would have to face communism sooner rather than later. And to fight communism, he had to rely on totally loyal men, men who would fight for an ideology against another ideology. It had always been Hitler's policy to oppose the ideology of class war with an ideology of class cooperation. Hitler had observed that Marxist class war had not brought prosperity to the Russian people. Russian workers were poorly clothed, as they are now, badly housed and badly fed. Goods are always in short supply, and to this day, housing in Moscow is as nightmarish as it was before the war. For Hitler, the failure of class war made class cooperation the only just alternative. To make it work, Hitler saw to it that one class would not be allowed to abuse the other. It is a fact that the newly rich classes, emerging from the Industrial Revolution, had enormously abused their privileges, and it was for this reason that the National Socialists were socialists. National Socialism was a popular movement in the truest sense. The great majority of National Socialists were blue collars. 70% of the Hitler Youth were the children of blue-collar workers. Hitler won the elections because the great mass of workers were solidly behind him. One often wonders why 6 million communists who had voted against Hitler turned their backs on communism after Hitler had been elected in 1933. Well, there is only one reason. They witnessed and experienced the benefits of class cooperation. Some say they were forced to change, but this is not true. Like other loyal Germans, they fought for 4 years on the Russian front with distinction. The workers never abandoned Hitler, but the upper classes did. Hitler spelled out his formula of class cooperation as the answer to communism with these words: "Class cooperation means that capitalists will never again treat the workers as mere economic components." Money is but one part of our economic life. The workers are more than machines to whom one throws a pay packet every week. The real wealth of Germany is in its workers. Hitler replaced gold with work as the foundation of his economy. National Socialism was the exact opposite of communism. Extraordinary achievements followed Hitler's election. We always hear about Hitler and the camps, Hitler and the Jews, but we never hear about his immense social work. If so much hatred was generated against Hitler by the international bankers and the servile press, it was because of his social work. It is obvious that a genuine popular movement like National Socialism was going to collide with the selfish interests of high finance. Hitler made clear that the control of money did not convey the right of rapacious exploitation of an entire country, because there are also people living in the country. Millions of them, and these people have the right to live with dignity and without want. What Hitler said and practiced had won over the German youth. It was this social revolution that the SS felt compelled to spread throughout Germany and to defend it with their lives if need be.